what are capitalism and socialism. I'm going to give you a little exercise this morning in defining socialism. And then ask what kinds of economic systems characterize the East and the West today. Then how have they evolved, especially since 1920? Can we detect directions of evolution in the economic systems of East and West? Then how are they likely to evolve in the future? And then finally, the grand finale question on Friday, is there real hope for an amelioration of East-West conflict through the convergence of economic systems in the future? Okay, so that gives you a general idea of where we're going. No. Well, no. In a book. All right. What is an economic system? Most people, I think, are fairly fuzzy about this. An economic system and an economy, these are synonymous terms. I want to give you a definition of an economy. It contains four key terms, then look at each of these. An economy is I'd like to make my rhetoric come out. Do it this way. That's a noisy blackboard. That's part of keep getting you awake, though, for a 9:15 hour. An economy is a system of social organization for securing cooperation among people and the use of available resources to satisfy wants. All right, I want to look at these. Anytime you've got a question or a comment or a loud disclaimer, just yell out. First of all, a system of social organization. Economics is a social science because it studies systems of social organization. One of the questions that people, or comments that people frequently make to me when they find out that I'm an economist is, you must really know how to play the stock market. I don't. The person who knows how to play the stock market successfully has some kind of knowledge that is privately useful, but not socially very useful. And I don't have any special inside tips on the stock market. Or even worse, people say, golly, you know, I ought to take some economics sometime so that I can figure out how to make the family budget balance. I do not even use a family budget. And I don't know anything about making it balance that you don't know. Economics is useful primarily for understanding systems of social organization. It is not true that you study economics in college in order to equip you to be a better businessman or to be able to manage your household affairs more effectively. There was a lady, dear friend of mine, who was the head of a home economics department at a university I once taught, and she kept sending her poor girls over to take these abstract economics courses because she was convinced that some of that would teach them how to buy better oranges. I tried to dissuade her from that, and she never understood, but she always got insulted. She always thought I was saying that her girls were too stupid to take economics, and I just felt sorry for the poor girls. But economics studies systems of social organization. That's its utility, and it's of little value for understanding individual economic problems. Now, it's a system of social organization for securing cooperation among people. This is terribly important, and we don't realize how important it is. There are 200 million people in this country. Of course, a lot of them are kids. Some of them are retired and don't do much. Some of them get paid but don't do much. But still, there are an awful lot of people doing an awful lot of different things. And you know, we all specialize to an extraordinary extent. Professor Strang there, golly, he's a terrible, he's a catechist. I know you hate that. I should not. Yeah. No. How can a man feed his family? Well, I'll pick on myself. How can a guy expect to feed his family and provide shelter and clothing for the family and all sorts of other good things in life by doing nothing except teaching economics? I'm a terrible specialist. I can't do any of the things for myself that I like to have done. But yet I'm not frightened and afraid. I don't know how to pound a nail straight. I don't know how to grow wheat, much less mill it into flour, turn the flour into bread. I can't produce for myself 1/100th of the things that enable me to stay alive and enjoy life. And yet I don't worry about it. I just teach economics, which is a very specialized occupation. And then I use the money that I get from teaching economics to bribe other people to provide me with bread and clothing and shelter and stuff like that. Now, when you reflect upon it, I live, as you do too, an extremely perilous existence. Have you ever thought about that? Suppose that all of a sudden, well, let's suppose that you make hula hoops, and that's all you know how to do. And all of a sudden, people decide that hula hoops give you aching sacroiliacs. The demand for hula hoops collapses. Now, how are you going to get the money to bribe other people to do the things that you want them to do? Let's look at a different aspect of the problem. Suppose you're sitting in your backyard, in your lawn furniture, reading Kafka, and suddenly there's a clunk and your lawn chair collapses, and you realize that a little nut came off, and you hunt through the deep grass and you can't find it. The grass is deep because you've been sitting in the lawn chair and not mowing the grass. You can't find the little nut, and you can't sit in the chair. It's tilted terribly without that nut. So you go down to the hardware store, and there you purchase a little nut that fits the screw that runs through your lawn furniture and enables you to sit comfortably some more. Now, you pay 2 cents for that nut. Now just think for a moment how many people cooperated in getting that nut to you. Just think about it for a minute, what it took. Of course, the guy in the hardware store and the person in the back room who takes care of the ordering of nuts, who goes through all the little drawers and says, we're out of 5/8 hexagon-type nuts. And then, of course, the people who manufactured the nut, then you can push it back, but the steel had to be made, and the ore had to be gotten out of the ground, and the coal had to be mined and brought together with the steel. There were boats that were plying the Great Lakes in order to see to it that you got your 2-cent nut when you fell out of your lawn chair. Or think about, I'm trying to impress upon you something that we don't think about, and I think we should. If we thought about it, we would appreciate something that's very important here. Think about the people of New York City, Manhattan Island. There are how many million sitting on Manhattan Island? 3 million people on that island, maybe? Huh? Well, all right, say, as the sun comes up, how many people are sleeping on Manhattan Island? An awful lot. And, of course, there are going to be scads more coming onto the island during the day and having lunch there and drinking water and relieving themselves. Now, think of all of the resources that have to be organized. You know, you go down to the store and there's a bottle of milk when you want a bottle of milk. For all these millions of people, what an extraordinarily complex system of social cooperation is operative there. When you think about it, you say, golly, it's bound to collapse at any minute. But it doesn't. How do we create and maintain this chain of production? And it is a chain. It's a chain that requires retailers and wholesalers, a transportation network, factories and factories that supply factories. How do we secure cooperation among the millions of people that are involved in the satisfaction of everyday wants? This is the most important task that an economic system must fulfill. It must secure cooperation. All right. The other terms, available resources and wants. What kind of cooperation? Well, cooperation in the use of available resources. This is worth stressing because we sometimes forget that resources are not available in unlimited amounts. That means that if we decide to do one thing, we can't do something else. If you use resources here, you can't use them there. Choice is necessary. John Kenneth Galbraith, in his book, The Affluent Society, has tended to obscure this fact for us. I'm not saying that what he is saying isn't valid up to a point, but many people have drawn from Galbraith the conclusion that in this society, this affluent society, is not necessary to choose. It isn't necessary to say, well, I want that so badly that I will do without that. That is necessary in our society. It is necessary for every one of you. It's funny, I've heard people stand and say, in this affluent society, scarcity is a thing of the past. I was listening to a very distinguished Woman lecture a couple of months ago, in which she made that statement. Scarcity has been eliminated from American life. And everybody nodded wisely, and that's ridiculous. Scarcity has not been eliminated from the life of any one of us. Scarcity means that available resources are limited, and that if you want to do this, you may not do that. Now, if all you mean by the elimination of scarcity is that the things that we have to deprive ourselves of in order to do the things that we want to do more are not terribly urgent, well, that's okay. But because that's always a matter of judgment. If I have to do without brandy in order to eat steak, it's your privilege to say that I'm doing without something that isn't really urgent. But if I happen to be a real brandy connoisseur, doggone it, I may be sacrificing something very important. Anyhow, choice is necessary, and choice is necessary in society. Right now, we're facing the necessity of choosing between supplying more men and materials to Vietnam or supplying more men and materials to the war on poverty here at home. And it is a choice. Now, of course, there are other alternatives, too. What we could do is maintain the war on poverty full scale while we're maintaining the war on the Viet Cong and deprive ourselves of automobiles and things like that by raising taxes. But, of course, that alternative we reject. All right, now, to satisfy wants, whose wants? Wants are many. Wants are diverse. And wants are apparently unlimited. They vary sharply in their importance from person to person. Well, if you're going to have a system of social cooperation for satisfying wants, you've also got to have a system for deciding whose wants and which of whose wants. That turns out, too, to be a very difficult problem. Well, now, an economy somehow has to answer these questions. It has to come up with a technique for securing cooperation, some way of deciding what's available and how what is available can be used and which wants shall be satisfied, and then mesh the whole thing together. I might just mention, if you look at that, an economy includes everything, really. I mean, you could say that the economist studies the technique of sermon writing, because sermon writing is a social activity, and you have people in mind, it's part of the system of social organization. And what you're trying to do is secure cooperation, maybe between the Holy Spirit, but that's an available resource, in a sense, to satisfy. In a way, this is the problem of all of life, isn't it? The problem of all of life is using available resources to satisfy wants. And whenever we do this in a social manner, then we're doing the kind of thing that the economist studies. Now, I do not want to pretend that the economist studies all of life, as that definition would seem to imply. In practice, the economist confines himself pretty much to things that can be exchanged. Now, unfortunately, that doesn't exclude much, because almost everything can be exchanged. You'd be surprised what can be exchanged. Everything has its price. Keep pointing that thing at me. Are you going to shoot me? Okay. No, it doesn't matter. I just always get caught with my mouth open.
I'm trying to avoid.
Yeah. since almost everything can be exchanged, really in practice, the economist confines himself pretty much to the study of the use of available resources to satisfy the kind of wants that are satisfied by things that enter into gross national product. But we won't worry about the definition of economics. The economists don't study everything. Well, now, let's come to the key question for this morning. How many kinds of economic system are there? The usual way of putting it today is to say there's capitalism, and there's socialism, and then there's the mixed economy. Well, I submit that's not a very satisfactory way of classifying economic systems. In order to try to prove that to you, I want you to attempt this morning to define socialism. We all talk about socialism. I challenge you to define it. Now, you say, well, what's in a word? Anybody can define something. But I'm asking you now to define socialism in such a way that you do not exclude from socialist any prominent group that is called itself socialist. Somebody want to define socialism?
Well,
Come on. This is part of the waking up process.
Would be more of a system of bodily government, in which government seeks to take care of the needs of the people more than capitalism.
Okay, let's try that. System of fatherly government, in which government tries to take care of the needs of the people more than in capitalism. All right, now, number one. Well, I mean, let me just point out some of the problems here. Was Stalin fatherly? Kind of a tough uncle, more like. But as soon as you introduce that word government, you're excluding a lot of socialists, because the whole anarchist school of socialism believed that government had no role to play. Marx himself talked about the withering away of the state, so that in the ultimate socialist society, the government wouldn't be doing anything. An awful lot of, historically, especially in the 19th century, socialists were extremely suspicious of government. They saw government as the tool of the bourgeoisie, the tool of the reactionary classes. And the paternalistic government was exactly what they were against. I'm talking about many, many socialists of the 19th century and some socialists yet in the 20th century.
How would it work without some organized...
Well, all right, let me give you one example. The syndicalists, who were very prominent around the turn of the century, argued that... And by the way, this fed into the Russian Revolution, too. They argued that what would happen is that the workers, the people who worked in a factory making dolls, that comes the revolution, they would just take over the factory, and they would run the factory. And you would have every workplace would be managed by the workers. That's all. That's all. Yeah. They didn't see the horrendous problems that raises. But that was a, it was, and this is a vision that runs way back. In the United States in the 1840s, this was our period, our great period of utopian socialism. And when producers' cooperatives were springing up all over the place and springing out just as fast, where people had the idea that the great reconstruction of American society would come when workers owned the means of production. And so there were all kinds of little attempts and some big attempts to just have the workers managing their work. And then the vision would be that, so you're producing dolls, and that means that what do you need to produce dolls? You need hair from a hair factory. And so the worker's representative gets on his horse and rides over to the hair factory and says, "Greetings, comrades, how about sending us some hair?" "Fine, fine." So they cooperate this way, and they're friendly, amicable relations among all the workers' factories. This idea fed into the Russian Revolution, the very name. The official name, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, Soviet. A Soviet is a workers' group for running a factory. And the Soviets played a big part. What would you call them? The Soviet is a kind of a militant trade union. No, that does not it. But it's a workers' organization which seizes power. That's what happened in St. Petersburg during the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. And the Soviets played a big part in the victory of the Bolsheviks in 1917. And the belief remained around for a couple of years that some of the Soviets would be the key to the administration of the whole economic system. You'd have Soviets in every city and Soviets in various factories and then Soviets of Soviets. And somehow or the other, out of all of this, you would get people's control of the economic system. And government just wasn't talked about very much. What are some other definitions of... Let me just toss out one very common one. Of course, it involves government again. But government ownership of the means of production. That was a very popular definition of socialism after World War II. But as we know, in the Western world, nationalization of industry has proved not to be so popular after all. So that the socialist parties in Western Europe are now saying that nationalization is not the route toward the socialist society. In some cases, nationalization may be good, in other cases, it may be bad. What about equality? This is one of the favorite ones. Yeah, okay, what does that mean?
Well, everybody's supposed to have food and housing and all the necessities of life, and you don't have a great deal of need for money that are taken care of.
Okay, you mean where everybody's needs are taken care of? That's social. I'm afraid you're describing utopia, not socialism.
Well, isn't that socialism supposed to be eventually leading to utopia?
Yeah. Well, let's just play for a moment with that idea of equality. Socialism historically certainly has been very interested in equality. Now, equality of what? The very term equality is an interesting one. If equality of income, would that be equality? Hmm? No, why not?
Well, when you think about equality, people aren't equal, because they've got the same amount of
money. Yeah.
Well, I've got the same amount of brains in the first.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't matter. See, as a good socialist, I'll say, I don't care that you're stupid. I'll give you just as much money as I'll give him, see, because you're a human being, so you're entitled. But now, you start passing out money. Are you going to give just as much to a man with 6 children as to a man with no children? If you do, is that equality? Yeah. Okay. Suppose, let me take a real.
Well, it has to be per person, not per family.
All right, but let's even try per person. Suppose that I'm the kind of individual who gets my greatest joy in life out of sitting on mountaintops contemplating the moon.
Oh, I think
that's the biggest. Well, wait a minute, hold it, okay. No. I work. Suppose I work. I work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, whatever I'm supposed to do. But my recreation is all I want is a little shack on the side of a mountain where I gaze at the sky and the trees and the birds and bees and all that. Now, somebody else also works 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. But his fun is nightclubs, fast cars, fancy clothes. Okay, now if the state gives each of us the same income, is it treating us equally? Yeah, for mine, no, absolutely not. I mean, I am much better off than he is. In a way, if you want to be equal, what you've got to give people is equal satisfaction. You know, now that's kind of tough. Or suppose that some guy is born colorblind. Now, I think that in order to treat him equally, you're going to have to give him an extra amount of money so that he can buy some pleasures to make up for the fact that he can't appreciate color. Now you can say, "Oh, you're quibbling. It's silly." I don't think this is silly at all. The notion of equality is a very, very tricky one, and all sorts of inequalities are regularly perpetrated in the name of equality. George Orwell said it: "We're all equal, but pigs is more equal than others." And it's funny how in actual socialist societies. The definition of equality tends to be restructured in order to suit the particular inclinations of the group in power. A striking example of this is the Soviet Constitution. Now, you know what Marx proclaimed as the great socialist principle of distribution: from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. I mean, that's wonderful, because that implies the end of scarcity, you might notice. There is no longer scarcity in such a world. But what does the Soviet Constitution say is the great socialist principle of distribution? From each according to his ability, to each according to his contribution. Sounds like National Association of Manufacturers would approve of that. Sounds like the marginal productivity principle of income distribution. And of course, the Soviets have followed this out. We sometimes talk about the death of incentive under a socialist system. Well, again, I don't know what a socialist system is, but if the Soviet Union has a socialist system, incentive is not dead. Now, it may be an incentive that is misleading, but they've got an incentive system with a vengeance. In the United States, for example, in a factory, the best paid non-managerial personnel in the factory, they typically earned about three times the wage of the lowest paid person in the factory. That's kind of a typical figure. So the guy who sweeps the plant out will make $5,000 a year, and the most skilled tool and die maker will make $15,000 a year, something like that. That's the range. In the Soviet Union, it may run like 20 to 1. Because they got a real incentive system. Of course, they're on a piecework system with a vengeance. Piecework system for everybody. Everything depends upon bonuses, and the bonuses depend upon your ability to hit all kinds of targets, so that everybody is continually striving to win the laurel wreath. Now, as I will try to indicate later this week, that system of brownie points, or success indicators, as they call them, often leads people to do the wrong thing. But it is an incentive system. There's incentive there. And of course, in the United States, back in the 1930s, if a factory manager bungled a job, at worst, he got fired. In the Soviet Union, he got executed. And that's called an incentive system. So there are tremendous rewards for success in the Soviet Union and tremendous penalties for failure. And that's an incentive system. If the carrots are big and the stick is heavy, then you got an incentive system. In the United States, we have made the carrots smaller and the stick lighter. And so we've really, that's the trouble with the capitalist system. It destroys incentive. if you start saying, well, the essence of socialism, I've heard this, the essence of socialism is the demand for and the pressing toward greater equality of income. Well, okay. Then I would point out that this has definitely been the historic trend within capitalism. That capitalism has pushed toward greater equality of income. Does that make capitalism socialist? I would say it's capitalism itself. You can argue about this, and there is a lot of argument about it. Some socialist economists, for example, will argue that capitalism has promoted not more but less equality of income. I find that their arguments for this are specious, and they just systematically ignore the evidence that doesn't fit their case. But there is remarkable consensus among economists of the left and the right wing that the devices which we usually hail or condemn as socialistic, I mean things like the progressive income tax, labor unions, let's just take these two examples, that these have not been very significant levelers of income. It's widely believed, for example, that labor unions have taken a big chunk of profits or property income and distributed out to the masses of wage earners. Well, if this is so, there is no statistical evidence for it. I used to play a little game with my students, asking them to, I would give them figures. Last year, I would say, the percentage of national income going to corporate profits was 12% before taxes. Percentage of national income going to compensation of employees was 69%. Those are pretty realistic figures. That would be, say, 1965. No, I'm not sure that's right, but that's pretty close. And I would say, what do you think the corresponding figures were in 1929? And students would usually come up with something, see, this is corporate profits, this is compensation of employees. I usually get some answers like 50-50 or even 40-60. Because the student, 1929, see, 1929, that was before the big progressive income tax, that was before the welfare state, that was before the trade unions. And obviously, once all these things came in, of course, we know that income was taken away from the capitalists and given to the laborers. Well, the truth of the matter is, it was about 12 and 69. you take a look at the drift in these figures over time, and you notice one thing, that in periods of recession, this goes down and this goes up. Because compensation of employees, now I'm expressing it as a percentage of national income, is a more rigid and inflexible figure. Now, wages don't flex as much as profits do. So that when national income goes down, the percentage of it going to employees is larger, and the percentage going to profits can be quite small. 1932, 33, it turned negative, for example. Profits were actually negative. And in boom times, this goes up and this goes down. With the result, of course, that in boom times, profits swell, and trade unions scream that we're getting scraunched, we want more, so they demand more, and it's a perfect time to pay them more, so they get more, because there's more available. And then they say, see, we are effective in redistributing income. But they're not really doing much, they're just getting what they would have gotten in the long run, maybe getting a little bit sooner. But we do very definitely exaggerate the extent to which, I don't know what you call it, socialist measures, or, I don't know, have redistributed income in this country. Of course, that makes some people very happy, makes some people very sad. There are a number of writers, Gabriel Kolko and Blake Paul Baran, who look at these figures and just, they say that proves we need a revolution. Because no matter what we have done, all these reforms that Norman Thomas said have brought in the socialist state haven't brought in the socialist state at all, because income is still distributed roughly in the way in which it was 45 years ago. The great Italian-Swiss economist, sociologist, philosopher Vilfredo Pareto enunciated a law of income distribution, which is really rather complicated. It's a statistical, analytical, and philosophical law, but in effect he asserted that you can't alter the distribution of income. That the distribution of income is determined by profound forces that will work themselves out no matter what you do. And you know, there's a tremendous amount of truth in this. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate it, but Vilfredo was pointing to something rather important. If you were to take all of the wealth of the country, put it in a big pile, and then parcel it out equally, how many years would it take before some would be rich and some would be poor? There are hustlers among us, and there are deadbeats among us, you know, and there are differences of ability. And when labor unions, for example, some people say, well, how can it be? Labor unions for years have been out to redistribute income from the capitalist to the employee, and they've been working like dogs and collecting dues and striking and even getting killed sometimes. Now you're telling me they haven't done a thing? How can this be? How can it be? Well, the capitalist has so many ways to escape that it's rather easy to understand how it can be. If he has to pay a higher wage, he raises his prices, or he introduces more machinery, or he just shifts the nature of his production. There are so many ways in which the capitalist can escape. The Clark Kerr, who's become famous or infamous as the president of the University of California, was, before he foolishly went into administration, a very distinguished labor economist, and he wrote a famous article on this problem, the Can Trade Unions Alter Distributive Shares, in which he says, well, of course, under some circumstances they can, but then he looks at the circumstances under which they could, and you see right away that these are not the circumstances that prevail in the United States. He compares the labor unions throughout this article to bloodhounds, and the capitalist is little Eliza, and he's trying to describe the circumstances in which the bloodhounds can capture little Eliza, and he shows how many devices little Eliza has for escaping. He finally concludes that the only really effective way to do it is for the bloodhounds not to chase Eliza across the ice, but to be waiting for her when she gets to the other side. So in other words, what you do is you abandon traditional trade union techniques, and you wait for the capitalist to pile it up, and then you sock him with a capital gains tax or a wealth tax, something like that. But you have to be continually waiting over there. Pareto? Pareto, yeah. P-A-R-E-T-O. Vilfredo Pareto. That's your important name for today. Vilfredo Pareto. Italian. Basically Italian. But he taught at Lausanne. A very distinguished economist and sociologist. Sociologists call him a sociologist, and economists call him an economist. And I think, well, he is also a distinguished political scientist. Brilliant and cantankerous man. Mind, let's see, what's his big book? What's it? Trattato sociologico. I can't recall the English title of his big work. Mind and Society. Enough of this. I've been trying to suggest that it's rather difficult to classify economic systems as capitalist or socialist by just looking at the ambiguity of the term socialism. I want to suggest, and I'm going to use it all this week, a better way of classifying economic systems, because it enables us to ask the kinds of questions that are useful to ask. I'm going to classify economic systems in accordance with the organizational technique that they use to secure this cooperation. And there are, I think, three kinds of organizational technique, three techniques that can be used in a society to secure cooperation among people and using available resources to satisfy wants. These are tradition, direct command, and the market. Tradition, command, and the market. In every society of any size and complexity, all three of these are used. Tradition certainly plays a role in our society in securing cooperation. I mean, for example, there are more ministers' sons in the ministry than there are non-ministers' sons. Now, tradition didn't play the whole role here, but tradition certainly did play a role. A boy will not necessarily do what his father did, but he is more likely to do what his father did than somebody else whose father didn't do it is likely to do what his father did. One of my private little empirical studies, which will never be published, whenever I meet an undertaker, a mortician, I ask him why he is that. Because I concluded long ago that nobody would voluntarily look around and say, I want to devote my life to embalming people. Is there a mortician here? My grandfather was a mortician, because his father was one before him. He inherited it. And I have found in every case that fundamentally it was tradition. I mean, you sort of got caught into it. Like one guy, his brother had always gone out and shoveled sidewalks during the winter. And so when his brother went off to school, he took over the sidewalk shoveling. And then just at that time, the funeral home built a huge new driveway, concrete driveway, which needed shoveling. So he became, it's about 50% of his time in the winter was devoted to shoveling for the funeral home. And that got him in there, and pretty soon he was doing other things. And before you knew it, he was an embalmer and then took over the funeral home. And fundamentally tradition. All right, well now, enough of that. The tradition is always operative. Command is not as prominent in our society. And by command, I mean a system in which somebody sits up at the center, a person or a group of people, and issues orders that are then transmitted down through some kind of bureaucracy or administrative chain of command until finally the people who have to do the concrete tasks get their orders. A command technique for securing cooperation is a centrally administered one. All right? The third alternative is the most fascinating one, and that's the market system. In the market system, people are also commanded, in a sense, to do something. But they're commanded in a rather indirect way. In a market system, basically, everybody does what he wants to do. But the things that he can do have price tags on them. And he looks at these price tags, and he consults his own preferences, and he acts accordingly. Thus, in a market system, in a way, everyone is free to do what he wants to do. But of course, he's not completely free. He's only free to do what he wants to do if he's willing to bear the sacrifice. I was talking to Jerry Doble yesterday. He's been in business for a while, a member of our board. He's now studying law. And he was chuckling about it. He said, I just decided I wanted to be poor like all the other lawyers. He is well aware of the fact that the lawyering profession is rather overcrowded. And yet he wants to go into it. Well, he's free to do what he wants to do, but he's going to have to bear the penalty, which means that unless he can establish a name for himself, you know, there's always room at the top, he may have to put up with a somewhat lower income than he could make in some other line of endeavor. So in this sense, you're free to do what you want to do. But the important thing, of course, is that there are these signals which are going out all the time. Prices, basically, that set costs upon things and determine the rewards for doing things. And it is in this way that the system gets coordinated. Thus, if you suddenly wake up one morning and you say, oh my gosh, somebody forgot to issue instructions to some people to cooperate with the rest of us by milking the cows. We slip. You don't have to worry about that. Do you ever worry that there won't be enough cows? Milk is terribly important. What if some people decided cows smell? What if everybody decided cows smell? So who wants to milk cows? Who wants to raise cows? So they let the cows die off. They cut them up for sausage. And all of a sudden, there's no milk. Do you worry about that? Do you ever worry that there won't be enough people to clean out the septic tanks? That's bad work, too. Why is it that there always seem to be about the right number of people doing the things that need to be done? The answer, of course, is that in a market system, as soon as there start to be a few too few, the reward for doing it begins to go up. And as the reward for doing it starts to go up, people change their mind about how offensive that smell is. Now, I don't want to glorify the system, but that's kind of how it works.
Fine.
Let them disappear.
That's 78 cents a gallon in Minneapolis, all over, nothing like Seattle. You're a buck.
Well, but that's fine. If these people don't want to be dairy farmers, I say that's bully. Let them get out of it. One of the problems which has created the present unrest is surplus of dairy farmers. Now there can be a period. Too many. The price of milk is so low that they leave in floods. And then the price goes up very rapidly, but it will tend to come back down. A high price is going to pull people in. Remember a few years ago when the price of hogs fell so terribly and all the farmers said, boy, I'm never going to grow hogs again. And the price of hogs skyrocketed within a year. And everybody was putting in hogs. Sometimes it gets to be a very unstable and erratic system. But the signals are always working so that when the milk price goes up, that encourages farmers to more people to be dairy farmers. It encourages the farmer who isn't a dairy farmer to put in a few cows. Okay.
The problem here at present, because of the fact that between the farmer produces and the consumer, there's a middleman who really makes the problem.
Are you a farmer? The poor middleman has been attacked in this country for 100 years. Back in the 19th century, it's always been the American tradition that you don't attack any laboring man. And even capitalists work, we believe it. Capitalists work and they risk and they venture. Well, if the capitalist is working and the laborer is working and the clergyman is working and everybody's working, what's wrong with the country? How come I'm poor? And the answer is the middleman. And so you have these pictures, of the farmer. You remember the cartoons, the farmer toiling in the field and the workman toiling at his bench and the consumer waiting, and somehow or the other, all that, everything is going off into the pocket of some big fat guy labeled middleman.
I just got a phone call from my wife, and I think we need to be organized as we're thinking, and that it isn't a living but a way of life.
Well, yeah, a lot of people believe this. And by the way, that's one of the reasons why some people in the cities are willing to subsidize farmers, because they want to preserve that way of life. Well, of course, not all farmers agree with you, that's the thing.
They need to be educated.
Okay, well, I don't want to get into a discussion of the essence of farming or what there. You're pointing out that there are lots of factors on the basis of which people make their decisions about what they want to do, and not everyone is attracted just by money, but you're also pointing out that money is terribly attractive.
I've listened to farmers' side of it for a long time, and a lot of my students often feel
Well, maybe. I don't know. No, that's okay. I want to quit. Just say there are these three techniques for securing cooperation: tradition, command, the market. In every economic system of any size and complexity, I mean, ruling out aborigines in Southeast Asia, there's some of each in all. The live issue in our time is this: is the command technique better than the market technique, or is the market technique better than the command technique? That's the real live issue. Now, socialism has the reputation of being oriented toward the command technique. Capitalism has the reputation of being market-oriented. Tomorrow, I want to discuss the question, well, what kind of organization actually characterizes the economies of East and West today? Have we oversimplified the problem? Nothing is pure except my heart. Well, that's what Ernie said this morning.
Ernie said it's okay. You can seem to find out this kind of approach to a retreat center. You always get people talking. You did the theology and the theology and the buffalo. There's that command. Then you mark it out.
Well, listen, we've got a little time to stretch, and then Dr. Baton.